You are listening to Secret Handshake, the podcast covering the movies that help you identify your friends and maybe make a few more along the way. Coming up, a very special bonus episode covering the boys' favorite films of 2024. Featuring ninjas, architects, tennis players, queers, cookies, serial killers, call girls, reform schools, war rigs, neo-Nazis, slashers, priests, Demi Moore, the Pink Opaque, Long Legs, Lost Souls, Hitmen, Sebastian Stan, Singing Witches, Lisan al-Ghaib, Chicago Bikers, and Edward Norton's forehead. Martin.
Yes.
What do you think about this boner? Edition of Secret Handshake. I'm your host, Jacob Knight, and joining me as always is Martin Carlson. Martin, another year in the books.
I know.
It's really weird because I think a lot of people consider 2024 to be sort of a subpar year for movies.
Yeah.
And for me, this is the year where movies were fully back.
Yeah.
And I think, like, you know, we were prepping for the episode before. And I shared my kind of overall list for the year with you. And, like, it's 25 films deep.
Yeah, and it's stacked across lots of genres.
Lots of genres, and lots of countries, lots of budgets, lots of different ranges of films from, like, studio movies to, you know, foreign independent features. And I guess, you know, to lay it out for the viewer, what we did this year is kind of what we did for the last couple of years, is that we decided to just pick five apiece.
Yeah.
So that we could kind of compile a master top 10 for Secret Handshake, and that we did it and we shared it with one another so there's no overlap.
While there would be otherwise.
A lot of
our top five are similar.
Precisely. Yeah. So did you want to kick this one off or me?
Yeah, I'll start.
Okay, yeah. Go with your number five.
Number five, I would do The Substance, which I think is a really interesting movie. We were talking kind of off mic about not just the film itself, but like the reaction to the film, you know? It's been an interesting year of the importance of social media for the success of a movie. There was a lot of talk, I feel, around The Substance when people started to see it. Kind of like Nosferatu had a similar success.
Sure.
Based on people like on Instagram and...
Well, it's kind of the annoying thing about how, you know, people consume movies anymore,
yeah,
too, is that it's almost like movies live and die by how memeable they are.
Like Barbenheimer was the definition.
Precisely. But The Substance was a movie that almost feels like out of any movie in 2024 had its life cycle kind of extended because it was so easily grabbable and memeable in terms of, like, you know, A, the finale.
Yes.
Which, you know, all of a sudden showed up in my Twitter feed a million times over as soon as it hit MUBI or any time of, like, streaming platform, but also just simply like all of the scenes of like Margaret Qualley, like in the spandex, like doing the gyrations, or Demi Moore laughing as she's kind of falling apart and watching Margaret Qualley on the TV and like
stuffing
her face and destroying her apartment and stuff, is that it became like a, oh man, I really feel like X here, and you would just insert a GIF
yeah.
from The Substance. But I mean, like, as much as that type of shit annoys me, it is the way that people consume and interact with cinema anymore, you know, for better or worse. And like, the more you see something being consumed and shared that way, it almost is like a gauge of its popularity, or at least like kind of the way that it grabs the cultural zeitgeist.
Yeah. No, 100%. And it, you know, all that being said, though, I think the film succeeds just on its own right, that it's this film with a really interesting background of, you know, what, a $20 million movie, and Universal sees the cut and is like, we can't release this. That's the story, right? And then, you know, Mubi ends up getting a hold of it. And
after Neon, because here's the thing that gets lost in that story, too, is that as much as we like to praise A24 and Neon as being like the coolest kids on the fucking block,
yeah,
they passed on this movie, apparently. And Mubi was like basically one of the last in line who was like, yeah, we'll pay for it and we'll put it out. Like, nobody wanted The Substance. And now, you know, Coralie Fageot and the financiers and Mubi are laughing all the way to the bank and the Academy Awards.
Well, and that's the interesting thing, too. We were talking off mic about the critical success of this. Obviously, it deserves it all. But the, as you and I both know, as a lot of people know, like, what makes it to the Oscars is so political. It's about what people get behind, right? And so, you know, the year, in a different year, Everything Everywhere All at Once would not have been close to the Oscars. It just wouldn't have been, right? I don't think it would have been. This,
I don't know, man. After Parasite, it's kind of hard to completely rule it out. I feel like Parasite, now Nomadland is the one I feel like is the one, is like the real write-off year, to where you're, yeah, like, would Nomadland have made it all the way to Best Picture had it not been for the, you know, the pandemic? I think Everything Everywhere All at Once is one of those weird films that's almost like the sins of Parasite, to where like people saw, and also the way that Parasite kind of represented not just the younger and international kind of voting body of the Academy Awards, but like Everything Everywhere All at Once was kind of an extension of that, of being like, we're going to continue that narrative to a certain degree.
And the hip side of things, too.
The hip side, yeah, of things.
Yeah.
Yes and no, but it's also just like, there's a new, like, nowadays, you know, like a complete unknown, a movie that we both really like, the Bob Dylan biopic, yeah, which is up for a bunch of Academy Awards and Best Picture and Best Director and everything.
An actor, yep.
An actor, which, and it'll probably, like, Timmy C is probably going to win.
Oh,
for
interesting.
A complete unknown.
Okay,
I think.
Yeah, yeah.
But, like, that feels like the most traditional Academy Award,
oh,
nominee.
Yeah. A Ron Howard-y, like, down the middle.
Exactly. Yeah. Straight down the middle. I mean, it right down to Walk the Line.
Yeah.
You know, it being almost like an unofficial sequel to that movie. That feels the most old Academy. And also, to a certain degree, I mean, The Brutalist, as much as I love it, and we'll talk about it here in a second, is that that feels like a movie that if, like, the Weinstein Company released it in 1998...
Yeah, like Shakespeare in
Love
era.
It would
be
the one,
yeah,
where he's, like, bulldozing. Like, it feels in line... Not Shakespeare in Love. It feels the most in line with something like The English Patient.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You,
yeah,
know, to where, like, he's bulldozing a path for this independent $10 million European-influenced epic to basically make its way to Academy Gold. Like, that feels traditional, in a, as radical as The Brutalist feels at times when you actually watch it. Its awards campaign feels traditional in the, like, the Weinstein kind of playbook sense for A24.
Yeah.
To where, you know, a complete unknown, like, that's a classical Hollywood move. The Substance feels like something we've never seen before in terms of, like, Academy play. I just think it's so fucked up and fucking weird. And, like, there's no movie think about it. In the history of the Academy Awards and Best Picture and everything, what's the last movie that we've seen that's influenced from everything from like David Cronenberg to Frank Henenlotter that was up for the, you know, the top prize?
No, I agree. And I link it very much to something like Everything Everywhere All at Once, where, but I mean, that you have a scene about trying to pile drive down into dildos, right? Like,
right.
It, so visually, there's a lot of different things, but it is that like really crazy fucking shit. I think it's in line with that. And people, it just really, it hit a nerve. And you also mix it with that almost Darren Aronofsky bringing an actor out of kind of not retirement, but semi-retirement and putting them back on top. The hero story of The Whale or The Wrestler, this is Demi Moore's year.
Oh, yeah. And if you didn't have that, the Demi Moore narrative, you wouldn't have any of the awards talk.
Yeah. And it so she's helped carrying that. And she's wonderful in it. Like, she's really, really good in The Substance. And Margaret Qualley is amazing, too.
Which is amazing because Margaret Qualley isn't nominated.
Yeah.
Like, she's the one that feels like the biggest snub, if we're going to use that term, of 2024. Because, like, without her, the movie doesn't work at all either.
But it's, you know, what I think is really wonderful about the movie, like you said, is it is a love letter to all the stuff we like. I mean, it's just, like, for true genre fans, just people who like schlock even as well, is like, here's this movie that kind of classed it up and like put it in this really amazing package, but also made its own really kind of special thing. It's super unique. It's super tight. It's super small in its way, you know?
I wouldn't call that movie tight. It's 144 minutes.
No, but I think like the world is tight. The world it creates is this very, you don't see much outside of their world. It's like her apartment, it's the studio, and that's pretty much it.
The New Year's Eve kind of finale with spraying blood all over the audience.
That's that new location. Yeah, and that's the moment. Like, I liked the movie until that point. I saw it with our friend Shapiro, my buddy Charlie, at that sneak preview, and it hits that moment, and I'm like, okay, now I'm in love. You know, like, this is, they're going all the way. And it's truly when her boob sack thing slides out of that, like that orifice in her body, it's just wonderful. Like, cause she goes all the way with it.
Yeah.
As a filmmaker. Like,
you saw Revenge, right?
I actually haven't seen it.
Really?
No, I haven't. I know.
Holy shit. Yeah. I feel like nobody has seen Revenge.
But I know Shapiro, like, he knows her. Like, he helped kind of champion that.
Well, yeah.
With Fantastic Fest.
I saw it at Fantastic Fest at its premiere at midnight. And that movie completely fucking flattened me. They also had to fight for it to be included in Fantastic Fest because that was one of the very controversial years where Drafthouse was going through a difficult time of scandal, we'll say.
And it's a rape revenge kind of story.
A very graphic rape revenge movie. But like Revenge, if you've never seen it, you have to. Like, we should watch it right after this because it is a gnarly, violent exploitation movie, and I feel like that's a thing that kind of gets lost in the conversation when talking about The Substance, is that you were just saying, like, The Substance feels classed up and elevated, which to me, it doesn't at all. Like, I feel like the Substance is glossy, and it's well-made.
I guess that's what I mean.
But at the end of the day, it's like an extreme exploitation movie in the same vein that Revenge is, and it's like almost hard to sit through at times because she's just rubbing your face. It's one of those, like, you know, what's the Garth Marenghi line where he goes, I know writers who use subtext and they're all cowards. Like, that's Carly Peugeot's like whole thing is that she's just like, I don't give a fuck. Like, I'm going to rub your face in absolute filth. And like, you know what the metaphor is the entire time, and I'm not hiding it. And that's what makes her movie special, because that's what the best exploitation is kind of built on.
For the cheap
is
seats.
That, like, you get it.
Yeah.
But like, exactly. I built it so that the dummies in the audience get it too.
Yeah.
So my number five is Nickel Boys.
Yeah.
Ramel Ross's adaptation of the Colson Whitehead novel about a boys' school and a couple boys who basically end up there. I don't know if mistakenly is the way to put it, but it documents basically their struggle with existence and continuing forward and finding hope. In a weird way, it's funny, is that like you can see the cross section of like popular American cinema of like something like Shawshank Redemption in like mixed with Terrence Malick's like Tree of Life, especially his like later period kind of
floating very camera,
ethereal floating camera works of art. And like Nickel Boys is just, it's unfortunate that this movie, it's been released by Amazon and like they and MGM, and they've tried to really push it and get it in theaters, and like it's just kind of been ignored by the American public mostly. And they push it as an awards movie. And like this for me is the most daring formal film of the year, where everything is shot from like the way that they'll try to describe it to you, like the most basic way to describe it to somebody is that the entire movie is shot in POV.
Yeah.
Is that you're always watching it from one character's POV or another's. Which is true to an extent, but the movie almost picks up like this omnisentient camera to where it moves from the character's POVs to where it almost takes on like a very, again, Malickian, godlike perspective to where you're not just experiencing what's happening to them on a day-to-day basis, but you're also experiencing like this kind of way that they interact with the cosmos to a certain degree, or like with life itself, which I know sounds incredibly pretentious and ridiculous, but like that's what the movie is for me, is that it's like, you know, Roger Ebert kind of famously almost had that quote about how cinema is like the great empathy machine.
Yeah.
And this is like one of the great representations of that, is that you're watching somebody just experiencing life, even in its hardships and in its small joys, and like these moments of time jumping, because you realize at a certain point the movie jumps. This is a mild spoiler, so I do apologize for the millions of people who have never seen this movie yet and will hopefully finally see it once Amazon releases it on Prime and everything, is that, you know, it jumps time at a certain point, and you realize that you're watching somebody's recollections of the hardest points of their life and how they both found difficulty and joy in those moments. And it's like so like earth shattering when that kind of realization kind of falls upon
you. It kind of crystallizes like,
and
what?
It's an incredible film. And like Ramel Ross, who's mainly before here been a documentarian, you know,
which makes sense based on what you're saying.
Exactly. Yeah. Like he brings this very lived in feel to like you feel like you're just walking in the shoes of like another individual the entire time. And also like you see actors who show up, you know, who like Hamish Linklater is in the movie, and he basically plays more or less like the headmaster of this vicious reform school, and he's fucking incredible at it. Like it's something that you've never seen. Like we love Midnight Mass.
Yeah.
And like we love him even in his like his minor role in something like The Stand.
Yeah.
But like here he shows up and just completely steals the show for his few scenes as like the villain of the piece. But he also, like Ramel Ross, allows him to imbue the antagonist of the picture was so much humanity and like sadness at certain points that you know you're watching real human beings the entire time. And also like while we're on the subject of like snubs, I'm talking about Margaret Qualley and The Substance. Like, Jomo Frey, the cinematographer of this film, like, the greatest visual accomplishment of the year is in Nickel Boys. The way he shoots this movie and the way that he captures in all of its glory, like, the way these guys experience life. Like, there's a moment where you're watching a conversation and the point of view jumps between characters, just shot, reverse shot. And the combination of Jomo Frey's cinematography with the editing allows you to actually feel like you transported between bodies in one moment. And it's just like, it's really magical stuff. Like, I can't recommend Nickel Boys enough. I was completely entranced for the 2 hours and 20 minutes that I got to watch this movie. Mm. So, like, that would be my number five pick of the year. Like, I think that this, when we look back at 2024, Nickel Boys is going to be the movie that people are like, fuck, I can't believe I missed that. Like, that you're going to say, like, I wish I had shown up for it, because it's going to be a classic that we talk about for years and years and years.
Well, I remember, I love that it was that year, many years ago, when it was the Best Picture and Spielberg was presenting it. And he said, you know, the film that wins tonight will join the ranks of XYZ. And the films that don't win will join the ranks of this. And it was all these films that never won that are much more highly regarded.
Right.
And like you said, have stood the test of time and become these classics. And obviously, I think this episode obviously becomes an award conversation, because it's like we're talking about the best of and what the Oscars may do. And, you know, my number four film, Anora, the Sean Baker film, is another interesting film in that if it had come out maybe later, or I don't know what, it got overshadowed. You know, I think so.
Because I still think it's in top three for best picture running.
But it's interesting how The Substance is taken, and The Brutalist as well, have like really, like, you know, kind of entered the top kind of competition. But Anora, I don't want to get into that conversation. I want to say, though, that Anora, we're both big Sean Baker fans, right? And it, here's a guy who's been getting better,
quietly been like one of the American masters,
and he's but also getting better every time. Like, he's, yes, like, it's like, I think my personal favorite is still Florida Project. I like that the world he creates of this, like,
I love Red Rocket too,
and I do too, but like, I mean, I love them all, but like, personally, I love that idea of
Takeout's pretty incredible.
I mean, all his early stuff, and now he's, you know, Anora, I saw it with early on with my girlfriend, and I was definitely in the mindset of, like, you know, being in love and like thinking about what is love. And I think this film captures, I know we and I had some disagreements off mic months ago about this, but how I interpret a lot of the film is like the different forms of love, right? And the different ways that love manifests. And so she's entering this kind of fairy tale world. I think she does buy into it a little bit of like, I just need to get alone. I need to find him and be alone with him to let him explain to me what's going on, and we'll be okay. When this wonderful magic act of, in the background, Igor, you see this character become this, that's real love. It's action, right? It's these little things like lighting two cigarettes for her that all culminates in this scene in the car at the end, which I think is one of the best scenes of the year. Performance wise, direction wise.
I mean, that's one of the most incredible things, is seeing that movie in the theater.
And, oh my, like, God.
The movie's such a, like, go for the cheap seats kind of like crowd pleaser the entire time. Like, it's, for me, I love Anora too.
Yeah.
Like, it's in my top 10 of the year. Maybe not quite top five, but close. But it's the closest thing that we've gotten to a Jonathan Demme movie.
Oh, just like Demme, the way he shot the center shots, everything.
Our buddy Travis Woods described it as ketamine Demme. And I think that's like one of the most apt descriptions.
It's
I've
definitely
ever
Safdie
heard.
As well.
Is very Safdie brothers, but also, like, it just has this again, enormous amount of empathy that all of Sean Baker's movies kind of exude and possess is that it's about finding the souls of these people that exist kind of on the margins and trying, at least inside of the narrative, to understand them as people. But like, the thing that's crazy about Enora is that it is like a straight ahead, like laugh along, thrill ride, crowd pleaser,
yeah,
until it isn't. And when it isn't is the last scene of the movie inside of the car in that moment of intimacy between her and Igor, where in my theater, when I saw it on opening night, the entire theater went dead silent.
Oh yeah, you could hear a pin drop.
And you could tell everybody walked out. And I remember even going to the bathroom in the Draft House South Lamar, and I overheard some guy, you know, coming out with his girlfriend and meeting up with the group of friends that they were with. And they're like, oh, what'd you think? He was like, man, it was really great until the end, when, like, I don't really know what I felt. And you're like, and I feel like, see, I disagree with you on the ending of this movie because I don't think it's a movie about love. I think it's a movie about identity. And I think it's a movie about a woman who shields herself inside of this caricature that she's created inside, yeah, of the strip club.
It's like bulletproof.
And she slowly allows herself, the real version of herself, to be seen, to where when we watch that end scene, it's so painful and so uncomfortable because that's the first time that she allows herself to not be Enora anymore. She's Annie.
Yeah.
You know, and like she, it's about allowing your defenses and your defense mechanisms to kind of be lowered and to allow like somebody else to actually touch you for the first time. And like then when she breaks down crying, I guess, again, spoiler alert for those who haven't seen the final scene of Enora, but like that's what's so painful about it, is that you're literally witnessing somebody allow themselves to be seen by another human being for the first time. And like, that's hard. That's hard to sit through.
Well, and what's interesting is I think we're saying tomato, tomato. I think that's love. I think there is an element. I
just don't know if she loves her. I think that she feels safe there, but I don't know if they're ever going to talk again. I think that's the greatest conversation to have about this movie, is that, like, you know, the rewatchables that the Bill Simmons podcast has that great question to where they go, well, what happens the next day?
No.
And you're like, well, what happens the next day in Enora? I have no fucking idea. But I don't think they ever see each other again.
No, what's interesting is I think that, because everything you said I agree with, right, of, like, being seen by someone, letting down your guard of, like, it's that, like, as you know, early in a relationship too, or like you're, you know, as a person who deals with anxiety, it's like you put this wall up of like, I want people to know me, you know? And I think there is an element, and maybe I'm being blinded by like being in love in real life, you know, but like you have that idea of that scene where also she's defaulting to, as a person, it's like, well, it almost feels like Igor doesn't want to have sex. Like that's not what he's there for. Right. She is like, this is what's expected of me in this moment. And it's this kind of like miscommunication where she just wants to be seen, like you said, like, and connect with like another human being. So I guess what I'm saying love is maybe like you're not, it's a different word, but it's like it is true human connection between these two people. Right. And you have this whole thing of like you go from this fantasy, right, of like this, whether she's what we don't even know exactly all the time where she's at mentally with what she's, well, I forget. What is Yvonne? Is that the guy she's with the rest of the time? Her husband.
Yeah.
Yeah. So his character is like
Vanya.
Vanya. So we are wrapped up in this narrative, right? And you watch the trailer and it's selling this like this Romeo and Juliet.
It's Pretty Woman. It's original. Like the thing that people, and I wonder if this was on Sean Baker's mind when he wrote the movie, is that like the original script for Pretty Woman was not the movie that we got with Richard Gere yeah. and Julia Roberts. Very famously, it was a dark movie about a prostitute who's picked up by a rich guy, whisked off to this magical kind of fantasy land. But it ends not with them running off together and being alive. He drops her back off into the reality of being a prostitute in the original screenplay for Pretty Woman. And that's what Anora feels like, is a visitation of that original idea of, like, you can be, like, Cinderella can be swept up into the fantasy of Cinderella, but in the end, she's still the ugly stepsister. You know what I mean? Like, she's always going to be that person.
No, and I agree.
And you can't escape that station in life.
And that's what's great about the film, too, is there's so much about how love and sex, too, is, it's about power, but it's also about transaction. There's a transactional nature to a lot of things in the film. And you have that, I think that moment again with Igor in the car is like, almost like, well, this is what is expected now. Like, there's a transactional thing of like, and then it's like, but that's not what's going on. And there's a transactional nature to her relationship with Vanya, right? If I will be your hot wife, you know, and you will give me, you know, you will give me diamonds.
You will get me out of being in the strip club.
Exactly. Basically. And the thing is, like, the way that the women talk in the strip club is like, oh, you bagged a big one, right? It's like, this is this fairy tale dream of a lot of them, of like, you get a John, you fall in love, quote unquote, and then you're out of this life, you know?
It's like my favorite part of the whole movie is that, what's the bad stripper's name? Diamond?
Oh, I love her so much.
She's like,
you'll be back.
She's like, yeah, she's the one who realizes their actual reality.
But it's funny because the movie, you're on the side of Anora and Vanya early on.
Well, yeah, of course you are.
And you're like, well, Diamond's a bitch. Like, you know, this is like, I don't agree. And then you're like, oh, wait, no, she was right. Like, Vanya dropped her like nothing once like reality set it. And that's why I love, again, the magic trick that Baker pulls off. And that's why I do believe there's a sense of, you have this guy in the background of Igor. You watch him change from this guy who's just kind of a henchman, you know, and the way that the writing is so good. Well,
and that moment when he turns it on inside of the candy store
yep.
and starts smashing shit is so fucking great.
It's amazing.
That's the Academy clip right there. Yep. That's what gets him the award. It's, well, that and the conversation at the end with Annie.
And the cigarette scene when he lights it.
But that's what I'm saying. Yeah, the conversation scene is like, because that's my favorite line from the entire movie where she goes, you know, you would have raped me. Like, no, if you would have been alone, you would have raped me. And he just looks at her and goes, but I am not rapist. You know, and it's just such an incredible moment of a guy being like, you don't see me. Like, I see you for who you are, but you don't actually see me for who I am.
Well, in the moment, too, that amazing, another Academy moment where he's like, you all owe her apology.
Yeah.
When they're leaving her, his horrible
thing. He's so fucking good in this movie.
Because, I mean, obviously, Mikey Madison, holy shit, she's great in this movie.
Yeah.
She's a dynamo.
Also, the biggest validation of my life, because, like, coming out of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and Scream, so many people...
That's what Sean Baker said, too.
I said, yeah. Well, not only that, I was like, I'm so attracted to that girl, and everybody's like, really? The weird girl from that? And I'm like, yes. And now Anora's come out, and everybody's like, Mikey Madison is hot, and I'm like, I know she's fucking hot. I've been telling you the whole time.
Yeah, but... This was a special movie. I just think that
it's
like,
really great.
Baker continues to knock him out of the park.
It's also just awesome to see Sean Baker, who's like not just one of the great American masters, but also one of the great like letterbox wizards of all time.
Yeah.
To where like he's a guy who's literally like, you know, extolling the virtues of like Severin Films' catalog and watching everything from Vinegar Syndrome. And like he's a guy who like really spends his time in the trenches watching the same shit that we do. But he's also making fucking Anora.
And he's a true indie master. I mean,
he makes movies on his own terms, on his own budget. Like he has a very distinct vision and set of themes that he returns to time and time again. And I mean, like the ascension from, I mean, I guess really Tangerine is probably the real starting point.
Yeah.
Because you go Tangerine, Florida Project, Red Rocket, and Anora. Then Anora.
Wow.
I mean, that's pretty special stuff right there.
And they're all fucking perfect films. Like,
yeah. I feel like Red Rocket is the one that gets lost in the conversation a lot because, like, the pandemic and everything, when it got released, it kind of got hamstrung a little bit. But, like, that movie is absolute dynamite, too.
I mean, Simon Rex, right?
Yeah.
Is another kind of casting against type or, like, you know, a guy who hadn't had a real chance in a long time. He is ridiculous in that movie.
He's so fucking good.
He's phenomenal.
Also, the movie that stealthily launched the Take That and Robbie Williams revival.
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, the Greatest Night song that basically scores the entire opening sequence of Anora, you know, that's Take That.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you have Better Man, the Robbie Williams biopic with the CGI monkey that comes in.
Which I love.
And which you really love and I still haven't seen yet. But I mean, like, Sean Baker was weirdly ahead of the curve.
Yep.
And being like, this is the next thing that's going to also not necessarily overtake America because, like, nobody saw Better Man, but
it is coming around critically. Like, people are like,
it's going to be a cult movie for years.
Yeah, absolutely.
So my number four actually pairs perfectly with Anora, and that's Baby Girl.
Holy shit.
Baby Girl. I've seen this movie twice and
we watched it together once.
There was a moment, and I still think every time I watch this movie that it might be my favorite movie of the year.
Yeah.
Like, it's the stealth contender for number one. Nicole Kidman, Harris Dickinson. It's about Nicole Kidman's a high-powered CEO of an Amazon-type corporation.
Yeah, they're doing automation.
Do, like, automation and compartmentalization, which is a pretty on-the-nose metaphor for how she kind of lives her life. She meets Harris Dickinson, who's an intern at the company, and they start a illicit BDSM-tinged affair. But Baby Girl pairs perfectly with Anora because it becomes about the armor that we create for ourselves in terms of identity and how we use that to kind of shield what we actually desire in life. And I think that Baby Girl is, in its own way, maybe the thorniest movie of 2024 because it asks the questions about, like, what do you do if you're in love with one person? You can build a life with one person, have, you know, a perfect family, career, everything, but still feel kind of unfulfilled inside of it. And you are able to unlock a level of desire inside of yourself with another person and pursue that sexual fulfillment and kind of pleasure,
but not
outside
love
of your marriage that doesn't equate to love. But it does equate to, see, here's the question, though. It might be love. Because, like, the whole father figure sequence, that montage inside of Baby Girl is, like, some of the most poignant, touching filmmaking I've seen in years. Not just in 2024, but a long, long time. But it becomes about, like, it starts asking the moral questions of, like, is it okay to pursue one and the other at the same time? Is it okay if you're dissatisfied with one to basically pursue the other and blow up the one part of your life almost in spite because you're not satisfied? And what does it mean for the people who essentially become collateral damage in the process? And, like, it does get a little on the nose in terms of, like, you know, Antonio Banderas plays Nicole Kidman's husband. He's a theater director in New York.
Doing Hedda Gabler.
Doing a Hedda Gabler adaptation. And, like, even he is, like, you know, arguing with the main actress about whether she believes it's about desire versus suicide and everything and what a man's perspective on Hedda Gabler means versus, like, a woman's perspective. But, like, that's the thing, is that the movie dares to ask these questions the entire time and also ask us whether or not that we have an antiquated perspective regarding relationships, love, family, existence, careers. Like, it's a very, very thoughtful movie inside of a package of, like, the erotic thriller that, like, normally doesn't take the time to ask you these things. And I think it's a really, really valuable film.
Yeah, you had seen it before me, and you brought it over, and we watched it, and I was absolutely floored by this movie. A, visually, it is the most, one of the most interestingly shot films of the year. It is, it's colorful, it's really esoteric.
Great New York
yeah,
movie.
Yeah, great New York, great soundtrack. I actually bought, I got the soundtrack immediately, really good synthy, like, clubby music. It creates this real atmosphere. But it's gonna connect to another film we're going to talk about in a bit with Challengers, right, of do we have this kind of, you said, antiquated view of family and of loyalty? Because you think back to the erotic thriller of like the 80s and the 90s, right? The Fatal Attractions, the Body of Evidence, right? There's this moralist sense of it's a mistake this person is cheating on their wife or their husband, right? That is the belief of the film is this is wrong, right? Of those older films. And yeah, it's sexy and here's this hot person like Madonna or Sharon Stone, right?
It's like the sex in those movies was always in service of the plot, where the sex in this movie Baby Girl is more in service of the actual character.
Yes, but you also have, again, you don't have so much the judgment of the film versus the question of, you know, like you're saying, is it possible to have this, you know, like you said, this relationship. You think about, you know, obviously we'll get to the Challenger's idea of how sex can be used as a tool. And it's not just about, oh, how can you cheat on your husband? Love is much more complex than that. It's power, it's money, all these things happening, and all these expectations of career, like you said, and these structures that aren't always serving people the way they think they are, right? And it's, or the question of her too, of Nicole Kidman's character of like, why can't I have it all? Like, I don't understand. Like, it's like this, I have this kind of, like you said, perfect life, but I'm unfulfilled. And, you know, that spoiler alert, the final scene, I love it, where she's finally able to orgasm with her husband, but in her mind is this image of the room where she first slept with Harris Dickerson with the dog. You know, it's this wild thing that she's able to look at and use. And it's almost like Antonio Banderas knows that. Like, he knows she's using that. For now, they get to use what she learned from him to now have their happy life.
Yeah.
You know?
It is an idealized version of what an affair can bring to a marriage. No,
yeah,
frankly.
Exactly. But it's interesting we're having this conversation versus the older films would have been like, oh, the woman's either a murderer or whatever.
But I mean, even Harris Dickinson's character says it directly to Antonio Banderas at one point, where he goes, you have an antiquated view of sexuality.
Yeah.
Like, that's a line from the movie, and it's like, that's what the entire film is about. It's about challenging your preconceptions of what sex and love and power mean inside of a relationship dynamic, and like, all while being wildly entertaining.
It's a blast.
And also might have the best soundtrack of the year.
No, seriously.
The needle drops inside of this, like
the dance George, scene.
Well, yeah. Well, also the Robbins, you know, dancing on my own.
Yep.
Scene, and then the George Michael father figure montage. Like, me and Shapiro saw this at a very early screening at South Lamar, and we went to our favorite bar, Silver Medal.
Yep.
And we asked the bartenders to put father figure on while we sat there and like drank beers and ate our burgers afterwards. And we're just like, this, I can't believe that they pulled this off. And also the In Excess.
Yeah.
Needle drop when they start to fall, when she and Harris Dickinson starts to fall in love too. And also, like, the thing that we've kind of left out is that this is in a career that might be one of the best, if not the best, actress career of all time.
Yeah.
Like, in Nicole Kidman.
She's phenomenal. Like, in terms of
a female movie star, like, nobody has had her career.
From TV to movies. Yep.
And, like, this might be in the top five of her performances. Like, she's so fucking good in this, not in terms of, like, how naked and raw she allows herself to be, but also in terms of how self-reflexive the role is, to where, like, she allows you to watch her get Botox on screen and do cold plunge therapy and do all these things that we as an audience think that the real Nicole Kidman does. You know what I mean? Yeah. And, like, it feels like her commenting on our viewpoint of her as a woman and a movie star.
Demi Moore in Substance, too.
And again, and playing with that idea of it, too. And, like, it's just, it's really clever, interesting shit that's happening kind of right in front of you. Not even under, again, the subtext is for cowards thing, but it's, like, not just underneath the surface, but she's just like, this is who you think Nicole Kidman is, so I'm just going to play her.
Well, and also, some people have found her performances to sometimes be cold.
Yeah.
And that's the character. He's this cold, cut-off woman, you know, for a lot of the film, you know, who's opening up more.
Well, and she also has, like, incredible comedic timing in this, too. Like, the whole, like, do you want a cookie scene, which has now kind of been already come online and everything was used to promote the film, is that, like, when he's like, oh, you know, you shouldn't drink coffee after lunch. How many do you have in a day? She goes, that's none of your business. 7. It's like, but she's so fucking good in the movie. And also the confrontation scene at the end.
Oh my God.
Of, like, the whole, like, you know, what happened between me and him is none of your business. Now don't you ever talk to me like that again. Now get the fuck out of my office. Is like, you just want to be like, all right, just end the movie right there. And it doesn't, because it has an even greater point to kind of make.
Well, and also Harris Dickinson, man, he's just awesome. Like,
talk about a dude who's having
a moment,
the career of careers. I mean, like,
Triangle of Sadness,
Iron Claw.
He's one of the best parts of that movie. Yeah, he's like the heart of it.
He's so fucking good. And I mean, like, even Beach Rats, the movie that Neon put out, where he's kind of like the teenage prostitute. Like, he's really, really great.
Well, he's gonna play John Lennon in the Danny Boyle fucking Beatles movie.
Yeah, I'm not thrilled, like, about that, but sure.
But I mean, That's a kind of a...
It's a big role.
It's a big role. Like, that's huge for him.
It's like the most... Wait, is that Danny Boyle or is it the...
Oh, Sam Mendes, sorry.
Sam Mendes, because it's like the four Beatles movies and it's like the most obvious motherfuckers that you could ever think of playing all the Beatles. Isn't Paul Mescal playing, like,
Paul McCartney? He's McCartney, and then Joseph Quinn is...
Lennon?
No, George
Ringo?
Harrison. Yeah, George Harrison. Lennon is Harris Dickinson.
Oh.
And then Ringo is...
Isn't that Irish guy with the name from...
Oh, Barry. It's Barry Keoghan.
Yeah, Barry Keoghan.
Yeah, you have the weirdest looking dude play him. So.
He's playing Ringo Starr. That's actually pretty fitting.
Yeah.
We got this weird little monkey looking man who we can't understand is Irish brogue.
Okay, so moving on to number three.
Number three.
So mine is actually The First Omen, which...
We saw together.
We saw together and both loved. Like, it was...
Good movie.
I know that Jacob's loving a movie when we're... So I'm like, totally engaged in this shit. Like, I am like, oh my God, like, I did not expect a fucking Omen prequel.
Yeah.
To be... What the hell is going on?
I mean, this is number one in terms of, like, the movie that had no right to be as good as it is.
It just, well, and I'm not even a big fan of the Omen series. I'm not. I'm not a fan of, like, Catholic-based horror. It usually bores me. Besides,
you're not even a big Exorcism movie.
Exorcism movies? No. Exorcist 1, I adore. But usually...
No, I just mean Exorcism movies.
I don't like them.
Everyone likes The Exorcist. You don't have to qualify that, Martin. But, like, you know, most people aren't like, I really like The Pope's Exorcist with Russell Crowe.
Yeah, but some people are like, oh, I've always liked that kind of stuff. I'm like, I don't like them. But this one was really sneaky, and it felt like the director had a lot of freedom.
Arkasha Stevenson.
Yeah, and because she had also worked on... Channel Zero.
Right. Which was She's worked on a bunch of TV.
A bunch of TV. And like Channel Zero is a great Canadian-based horror anthology series. All great seasons, honestly. Like season one, a very good kind of creepypasta. Then season four at Dream's Door, kind of a really crazy, almost brood. It's about the brood kind of in a way. Knocked it out of the park. And she worked on a lot of those. And this is just a like tightly made, smart. When it goes there, it fucking there's
yeah
a
the whole
scene.
Dream sequence with the hand in the vagina.
Yeah, thing. A hand literally comes out of a vagina in this movie. Like
it's gross.
And it's a what MGM is the company?
Yeah,
or 20th Century. It's 20th Century. It's fucking Disney. So it this movie absolutely blew me away. I was surprised, but I remember we were watching it in the theater. And I leaned over to make a point. And you go, shh, like you were so engaged.
Not now.
You're like, not now. I'm totally in. I'm like wrapped up. But yeah, this was honestly not a lot to talk about with this one. It's not a huge conversation starter, but easily in my top five of the year. A horror film that just really like surprising, effective, gory, actually kind of scary at moments. A good prequel too, where I was like, I would watch more of this. Like it has kind of a cliffhanger. I was like, I would watch more of this like prequel world. And I do want to mention Nell Tiger Free as the lead, giving a like
from our beloved Too Old to Die Young,
that and also Servant, the Shyamalan show, which I watched.
Yeah, not in the same league as Too Old to Die Young, but sure.
Well, also very good, which he just won a big court case about. But I watched that because of this series. She's ethereal. Like she is phenomenal in everything she does.
Yeah, she's great.
No, she's so good. Like, and this one in particular, she has a moment which is full on Isabelle Adjani in Possession, where she has this like body racking scene of possession out in the street.
Yeah.
Mind blowing stuff.
Water blowing, throwing up all over herself.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah. It's, I just think for anyone who's like a fan of just honestly any kind of like 70s vibe horror, like they capture it so well. The kind of Rome during like political protests and stuff. It's just, it's
good
very,
stuff.
It actually feels more Friedkin-y. Like it feels more like Sorcerer Exorcist than Richard Donner. Why are you giving me a weird face?
Because, I mean, like I didn't watch that movie at all and think about like Friedkin.
Oh, I did.
Anything, but you know, it's pretty good.
How dare you?
I know. Well, my number three to bounce off of yours is also a horror movie. I think the best horror movie that I saw in 2024, which is Pascal Plante's Red Rooms, the French-Canadian serial killer film. That is almost like dopamine for Fincher.
Yeah.
Since we haven't had a David Fincher movie, let alone a David Fincher serial killer movie in like since Mindhunters, really.
Yeah.
But for those who don't know, it's about a fashion model who develops a unhealthy relationship with a trial.
Obsession, yeah.
Of a serial killer who is on trial for basically killing three girls, they think. Two of which they have the videos of because he basically auctioned them off on the dark web in his red rooms where you could watch him torture them and dismember them to death. And then there's a third who the video and the body was never really found. And it becomes her mission basically in life to discover this video and body. And this is like the movie that challenges your idea regarding why you like these types of movies in the first place.
Or true crime stuff,
or
too.
Or true crime in general, and how you're able to allow your brain to fall down a rabbit hole anytime that you're kind of researching or engaging with a crime that's currently unfolding in front of you or like you said that you're watching a documentary for, is that like it's an interrogation. And the most like the filmmaker that this reminds me the most of is Olivia Assayas's,
dude, it's like Demon Lover.
Exactly. Yeah. It is Demon Lover just for 2024.
Yeah.
you know, and the main performances inside of this are so fucking good.
She's phenomenal, the lead.
Yeah. Like, she reminds me a lot of Renee Rengevez from Worst Person in the World.
Yeah, yeah.
And how we never... The most intriguing trick that the movie pulls on you is that you think the entire time that the mystery is finding out if this killer killed the third girl and whether or not she's able to uncover the third video, when really the mystery is about why she's so interested the entire time and whether or not she's interested because she's also a sociopath or she's trying to solve the crimes and vindicate the families, or maybe a C option, none of the above, that maybe she's almost trying to fill a gap inside of her soul that can't be filled by exploring these types of atrocities. And the movie's so fucking unsettling,
Jude,
and so unnerving at certain points. And there's a sequence in this that involves cosplay that's the most fucked up thing that I've seen in a movie in the last 10 years.
Well, and then like, the locking of eyes in that scene
and
it's chilling.
So fucked up. And like I almost stopped the movie the first time I watched it because I was like, I don't know if I can finish this. Like it got under my skin that hard and nothing anymore upsets me.
Do you know
like
what actually, that. You know, speaking of Fincher reminds me of the most of is that scene in Mindhunters where it's is it Edwin, the guy with glasses?
Yeah.
Where he finally touches him.
Yeah.
And he ducks to get out of the room. It's this moment of them.
And he can't escape.
He can't escape, but it's like the connection of like we're the same. And for me, that's that moment of him locking eyes with her.
Yeah.
You know, and her, yeah. It you showed it to me. You already seen it. You brought it over. And I was you're like, you're gonna like this. I'm like, yeah, I probably will. And I was like, holy shit, this is top 10 easily for the movie for a year for me. But you also have, we were lucky enough, not to get ahead of ourselves, but to see an early cut of The Shrouds.
Right.
You know, and it reminded me of kind of like this, in this post-truth society, of like what is even real? Like there is this, like you're saying, there's so many questions wrapped up in this character in particular of like, what are her motivations? Who is she? What happened? It's just question upon question. There's the sense of reality seems to melt in this movie.
Well, I'm glad that you brought up the comparison to The Shrouds because I thought of that too when we were watching that for the first time. Is that like The Shrouds, I guess for those who don't know, is David Cronenberg's newest movie and involves a man who's essentially
Cronenberg,
played by Vincent Cassell, who invents a new technology to where you can literally watch your loved ones decompose underground inside of their funeral shrouds. And one day his business is vandalized and he begins falling down a rabbit hole of conspiracy theory to try and uncover like what has happened that links back to even his own wife's death and everything. And you realize, I guess spoilers for a movie that won't come out for a few months yet.
It's April. Yeah.
April, I believe, is that it becomes a movie about how we use conspiracy and spin theories for ourselves to try and explain the unexplainable.
Yeah.
To a certain degree and make sense of death, which is just a natural part of life.
Yeah.
And Red Rooms does a very similar thing of like examining this idea of like, why do you continue to pursue these threads that have nothing to do with you? It's because it distracts you from not just the mundane nature of life, but also like the atrocities of like everyday life itself.
Yeah.
And it is true how these movies kind of play like sister pictures without even knowing one another, but they're both
Canadian. Weirdly.
And not only Canadian, but French Canadian at certain points.
Yep.
But like The Shrouds, I think it's going to be interesting to see, not to get too far off on a tangent, but it's going to be interesting to watch how The Shrouds is received because it is such a distinctly late style film
with some bad CG.
One of our greatest auteurs. I don't give a fuck about the bad CG, but it's more about how like we talked about it off mic, is that it, the movies that it reminds me the most of is that the Paul Schrader kind of final trilogy of
First Reformed,
Card Counter, and Master Gardener, is that it's about a guy reckoning with who he is at the end of his life and what the end of his life means to the greater picture.
Yeah.
And Cronenberg's,
or as people die around him.
Exactly. Yeah. And he's doing a very similar thing to being like, I'm going to die. What does that mean, if anything at all? And like, should I be more reckoning with all of the people who have died around me that mean so much to my, not just me personally, but also my career? And like, it'll be really, really cool to watch that kind of conversation around that movie unfold, if it unfolds at all, because it's such a small, very niche film that really plays only to like the hardest core initiated. Like, if you don't know anything about Cronenberg, I have no fucking idea how The Shrouds plays for you.
Well, you got to fill in a lot of gaps, right?
Yeah.
Like, you, and
it's
you,
so personal.
You and I were sitting there and we're like, oh, here's what he's doing, you know? And not that we're like so special. We love Cronenberg. So we're just like, we're eating up everything he's putting out.
He's
like,
my number one guy.
Yeah. I mean, he's top three for me, right? And I just like, and one of our, you know, in our pantheon here on the podcast of just our favorites.
Yeah.
But all right. So moving on to my number two, it's kind of a double feature, but it's The Year of Luca.
Our boy.
So you got Challengers and Queer, two pretty much stone cold masterpieces that, as you and I talked about off mic, show our different tastes in movies, right?
I think that you can judge a person based on which Luca Guadagnino movie they prefer from 2024.
Yep.
Whether it's Challengers or Queer, because like it says so much about them.
Well, and you had mentioned to me, like off mic months ago, when you're like, oh, it makes total sense. Like, you're a guy who likes perfect screenplays, writerly stuff. That's Challengers.
Yes.
And then Queer is this much more meandering, artistic,
weird
film. And I love them both.
It's
all vibes. And I'm a Burroughs fan, but I'm also like, Challengers, I got out of that movie and I funnily, there was all those jokes about people going as threesomes, like thruples went to see it. And I didn't think about it. I went with my married friends, Charlie and Harriet. We're like, oh, we're that. And it was funny. They both liked it. I loved it. I ran out of theater. Like, I mean, obviously the Reznor and Ross score is
transcendent.
But
the word you're looking for.
But what I love about this film is it connects again well to Baby Girl, right? Of these ideas of, it's not just like, oh, how could she cheat on her husband? Because it's not about sex. It's not about love.
It's power.
It's power. But it's also very much reminds me very much the transcendental nature of Whiplash, of you have these people, it's about professionalism, right? Of reaching that transcendent thing in what you do, of you finally see a good match of tennis, which is what she always wanted.
I think there's something different though, to where Chazelle is captivated by the technicality and the virtuosity of it all, and committing to the virtuosity. Luca is fucking Luca to his bones. And like, Luca's just like, here's two people playing tennis, but what they're actually doing, they're fucking.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Like, it's all about desire and sensuality and sweat and skin and like movement. And he's just, he's the most sensual filmmaker that we have, to where when people aren't actually having sex, they're still having sex. And it's absolutely incredible. And like, Josh O'Connor
in this movie
is like, it's watching a movie star be born in front of you. Like, he's so fucking incredible in this. And like, I always liked Mike Faced.
Yeah.
Like, even like going back to like, you know, especially Steven Spielberg's West Side Story adaptation. But like, he's great in it. But you want to talk about a guy who should be put in the cuck chair the entire time? Like, he's just...
What a titty baby.
But it's also, like, to go back to your idea of, like, how it links to Baby Girl, is that it's a movie about, like, what people want and desire from their relationships. Mm-hmm. And it really is about Tashi in the middle, Zendaya's character.
Oh, she's insane in the goodness movie,
and how
too.
About, like, you know, she's the Nicole Kidman in this, and that it's like she looks at Josh O'Connor and just sees raw dickhead sensuality the entire time. We're like,
and
Mike
talent.
Faced's yeah, well,
yeah,
that,
yeah.
Like, but I'm saying take all the tennis stuff
yeah.
away from
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah.
Talent is just a stand-in for he's got a great dick.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And then, like, here you have Mike Faced's character to where, like, he's not as talented, but he's going to work for it.
And he's reliable.
And he's yeah. reliable, and he's going to worship the ground you walk on. But, like, at the end of the day, does that get your pussy wet? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, that's what this whole movie's fucking about, is that it's about what gets you off. What do you want in a partner? What do you find attractive? And, like, at the end of the day, you find the dirtbag who lives out of his fucking CRV and can smoke you in tennis hotter than the guy who's going to be there and show up and raise your kids with you every day. And, like, the movie kind of asks, like, is that cool? Like, I don't know. But it really, the main question that Luca, like, answers with the final shot of the movie and her like jumping up and screaming, come on, is that it's like, it doesn't matter. Everybody just wants to come and that's it. And like, that's what his movie is about, is that it's like, at the end of the day, it's great sex. And that's what Challengers is.
No, I like that. And I agree with that reading. I've always interpreted, I've watched it like what, 3 or 4 times now. I love it. I just been watching it.
It's so fucking
when again,
good.
Again, purely entertainment. It's such an entertaining movie. But I like, again, she says early on, to connect it to tennis, though, mixed with, because it is about sex, right, symbolically, but you also have, it is a movie about tennis in a lot of ways, where you have, early on, she goes, all I want to see tomorrow is a good game of tennis, a good match of tennis. Because she, you know, she uses her sex and says, whoever wins gets my number. Right, and their first match when they're young, the first match
yeah.
we see them against each other.
It's always a competition.
But I think that Tashi though actually loves tennis because she was also, it was taken from her. Like she loved it. She was injured, right, and so she's had to find this new power as this manager coach. And you have this final scene of, again, it goes back to the beginning. All I want to see is a good match. And she sees the good match, which can represent them.
Yeah.
Because she wanted them to kiss earlier and, like, basically, you guys should just fuck each other. Right? And she gets to see that. But she also gets to see an amazing game where her kind of plan comes to fruition in a way, too, of Josh O'Connor's character brings out the best of her husband. Like, the mix of that stew. It's a complex ending, but I don't think there's a clear answer to what it means, but I love that about it.
Is it also the best live-action adaptation of anime that we've ever had?
It's like Creed 3.
Like,
it's
when
similar
they
filmmaking.
Jump into each other's arms in that final tennis match, like, it feels like something out of, like, a Dragon Ball Z cartoon.
Well, and then
it's
way,
so fucking awesome.
The shots where he shoots, he goes underneath the court. And it's the see-through thing. I watched this interview. It's great. It was one of those variety, like, you know, filmmaker interviews with filmmaker. And it was Denis Villeneuve and him. And
yeah.
they had never really met in person, but they were both fans of each other. It's just amazing. It's like a, what, hour-long interview with each other. And they're both just, like, in love with each other's filmmaking. But one of the things they talked about is, classically, Luca does not like to shot list. You know,
no.
a lot. But this film, he goes, this is the one I had to because it's tennis. I couldn't fuck around. I couldn't just show up and like get
well,
in
that's
the
thing
feel.
That we should talk about in terms of Luca's filmography too, is that like Challengers is the outlier.
Mm.
Where
it
Clear
looks nothing like, yeah.
is way closer to what we traditionally think of as a Luca Guadagnino movie, and also probably why I prefer it to Challengers is
yeah.
that like Queer has that meandering wavelength of like lonely desire. And that's what his
Call Me By Your Name
tap
and,
into the yeah. most. Like, Call Me By Your Name, even Suspiria.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I Am Love. Bigger Splash.
I mean, like Bones and All.
Bones and All. It's all about these lonely people longing for one another. And, like, queer is, like... Like, queer is in the same league for me. Like, this is a top three of the year movie for me. Like, yeah. This is the one I prefer the most because, like, it's so sad. It's so beautiful. It's so perverted at certain points and has, like, maybe the performance of Daniel Craig's career.
He's, oh my God.
The fact that he's not nominated for Best Actor for this movie is a fucking crime.
This is the
like the biggest omission
yeah.
from the Academy Awards this year. And like the chemistry between him and Drew Starkey is so absolutely incredible. And you want to talk about a guy who's linked his movie back to Cronenberg. Like, he's referencing Naked Lunch yep. so much.
The Inner Zone
making
stuff.
Making Queer yep. a direct sequel right down to the whole ayahuasca kind of climax and them more or less having, like, an erotic shunting together. And, like, it's so beautiful and it's so moving. And also, like, all the stuff with Leslie Mann where she shows up and, like, the lessons that she's bestowing while they're doing drugs together.
That's the best part of the movie.
Yeah.
My favorite part.
For me, the epilogue of the movie is the part where I broke down into absolute tears. And like the final shot of him putting his leg over his as an old man and like just remembering the way that it felt like he's the one who got away and he's the one who like every time he gets into bed that he thinks about touching. Like it's just like that's classic. Luca. Like,
yeah.
That's what Luca is all about.
Like the epilogue of Call Me By Your Name.
Yeah. So I love it. And also like, does Queer have the two greatest needle drops in 2024 with
Nirvana
Come As You Are, this sequence where Daniel Craig walks down the street in that fucking white, you know,
linen.
Bring me the head of Alfredo Garcia suit. And then also the New Order. Needle drop where yep. he's doing heroin. That might be my favorite movie of my favorite moment from any movie of 2024 is just that like I could watch that on loop over and over again. Just 2.5 minutes of Daniel Craig doing heroin and listening to New Order in the middle of the night. And it's so captivating and like vibe heavy, but it's also like, again, where me and you diverge in terms of what we like when we watch movies is that you like something more narrative based
tight
and tighter to where me, I just want all the feelings and weird emotion. And like, if you just hook me into like a frequency, I don't give a shit about the story. Like, I just want to feel something.
And I mean, Naked Lunch is one of my favorite Cronenberg films too. And so I love, like you said, the connection. I also love how artificial the film feels at times. Like it's so it's so like, this is a set. Like this is meant to be a set. His use of miniatures.
Yeah.
Like a lot of these miniatures when they're in
Mexico. Because he shot it all in Cinecittà.
Yeah.
The Italian studio and everything is that it's supposed to look like. Is it Morocco or?
Well, I mean, it's Mexico City, it's funny because Inner Zone is Morocco in Naked Lunch. Clearly, you know, it's that kind of like,
but like vibe. He replicates all of that, and it just looks absolutely incredible while also being like it's very De Palma-y in terms of how it's all artifice.
Yes, yeah, and it feels kind of small in a good way. But I mean, for me, the moments of almost, I wouldn't call body horror, but them melding together in the jungle when they're on ayahuasca. It was cool watching the interview with Luca. That's what they shot first.
Oh, wow.
And so he goes, because I wanted Drew Starkey and Daniel Craig to be comfortable with each other because it's going to be very sensual film. They're going to be very physical.
Yeah,
so,
I mean, he snowballs him.
So, yeah, I mean, but they had to have perfect synchronized movements to meld their bodies together. And they learned that and they learned how to get skin to skin. And he goes, I just figured we'd do that first.
Yeah.
Because what's what Denny was asking? He said, how are you able to capture better than anybody else? Like you said, sensuality with sexuality. Like he does these really like graphic stuff in a lot of his films. Other people wouldn't touch.
Yeah.
You know, like the peach.
I mean,
peach
James
scene.
Bond sucks a dick in this.
Yeah, he does. And then he comes real quick when Drew Starkey gets him, you know. But anyway, yeah. But it's a sexy fucking movie, though, too. Like, it is a very sensual film. It's romantic. It's sad. It's really sad.
Yeah.
It's such a, like, it's such a just, like...
A Jacob-coded movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, speaking of which,
yeah.
Number two, The Brutalist.
Woo.
Brady Corbet's almost four-hour epic about a Hungarian architect who's also a Holocaust survivor, played by Adrian Brody, comes to America and is enlisted by a wealthy industrialist, played by Guy Pearce, to make a community center. And it's about, it's very nakedly about the intersection of art and commerce, the relationship between the artist and the patron, and how those dynamics shift over time. And I've seen it three times now, twice on the big screen, one at home on a screener, and I can't wait to watch it time and time again, because I think it's, I mean, if I'm being real, there's a movie I've watched more that's my number one movie that's going to be on this list, but this is the best movie I've watched this year. Like, it's the movie to where I just sit there and I go, fuck, man, like, you really, you went out and you did a thing.
Well, especially in the context of his career,
yeah,
you know, because, like, you watch Childhood of a
leader,
sorry, which we watched for our Batman episode years ago, now 3 years ago now.
Yeah,
if you believe it. And then Vox Lux,
which neither one of us likes.
Yeah, I really hate Vox
and
Lux.
From the sounds of it, Brady Corbet doesn't like either, because it sounds like The Brutalist is a direct refutation of Vox Lux and his experience on Vox Lux. Battling with, because he's been, I don't know if it's because of, like, maybe a relationship or maybe there's an NDA thing or something, but, like, he's very tight-lipped on naming who did this, but it sounds like he didn't have the best experience on Vox Lux and that it ended up being a very compromised movie in the end, despite being released by Neon and everything, because The Brutalist was the movie that he and Mona Fastfold, his partner and,
yeah,
and creative partner, threw themselves into afterwards. And it becomes a movie about, you know, artists versus the patrons.
Yeah.
And it sounds like one of the producers on Vox Lux, like, compromised his vision in the end.
Interesting. We'll say. But even that being said, what a jump. In,
yeah, he's, I mean, never done anything that's,
holy,
like,
holy shit. I mean, like,
I mean, nobody has, though.
Well, I mean, for, and also from a nerdy, you know, film fan thing, like, the use of VistaVision. Like, it is,
yeah,
seeing the theater. I am, you and I are similar. Like, I love a good 80-minute, 85-minute, like, thriller, horror, slasher movie, right? But also all day. Dude, I saw Oppenheimer three times in 1 week.
Yeah,
like, I love a big fucking long ass movie. You know, like, I have no, this, these conversations about, oh, why is it so long? I'm like, eat, like,
who,
you know,
cares?
You know, I joke too, is like, yeah, but every Marvel film's like 3 fucking hours long. Like, why?
Well, and also, like, you'll sit at home and you'll binge fucking 6 hours of some Netflix series.
Or like The Office, like, yeah, fuck off. Yeah.
But you can't sit through, like, a very thoughtful, meditative art film. Now, granted, you know, it's a thoughtful, meditative art film about a Jewish architect and, like, his relationship to capitalism. So, like, might be outside of the mental purview of, like, the majority of the viewing public. But, like, it's a challenging movie. And, like, the length shouldn't be what's challenging about it.
Well, and it's very novelistic, right? It has this, like, in my mind, a very...
It also moves like a fucking freight.
Well, it
train.
Does, but it's very episodic, you know, and yeah, it has, and it's done very well where the pacing is perfect. The pacing, yes, is absolutely perfect. For me, after the, you know, seeing the theater after the
And he also, like, very mindfully bifurcates it.
And that's, so I really like the first half. I love the second half. So
where most people, I think the first half's the best part of the movie. I love the second half too, but, like, The first half for me is the one that just like chugs along like a sprinter.
Well, it's funny because I was reading this review of it and I was like, oh, this is why I like it, is like, while I am this, you know, more structured, narrative driven kind of guy, I also love Tarkovsky, you know, so I love that like European, like weird, dreamy shit. The entire sequence at the marble quarry is
one, oh my God,
is one of the most majestic things I have ever seen in my fucking life.
Where, and he pours the water yeah,
is maybe my favorite scene of the year. Like that, and the sexual nature of like Guy Pearce like caressing this marble and he's looking down the face of it. Oh my God. And that cuts to the dance scene of them like having this party.
Yeah,
there's that wide shot of the quarry, like that huge wide in this division is like cinema with a capital fucking C, man.
Well, the train wreck is the other one too.
Oh,
where,
yeah,
like you have the shot where the camera just keeps pulling back and keeps pulling back and keeps pulling back, and then the train actually explodes on the tracks.
Yes,
and it's just like it's one of those like, how did you pull that off? Moments, yep. You know, I mean, but for me, the sequence in the Brutalist, that the one that I feel the most is still the relationship between Adrian Brody and Felicity Jones.
Oh yeah, as drug stuff.
Laszlo Toth and Erzsébet, his wife, who he's been estranged from, and she's going through, you know, the pains from. You know, the injuries that she sustained during the Holocaust and everything.
And the disease she had, too, yeah.
And she had osteoporosis.
Yes, yeah.
And he gives her heroin to, you know, ease her pain.
Which he's been addicted to.
And
yeah,
he's been addicted to, and becomes like a stand-in for the way that he, and a lot of artists, frankly, like to turn their brains off from the noise of the outside world and even themselves. And like when he injects her and they finally connect and they have that sex scene that becomes that like gauzy, melancholy, like consummation of like bodies, is like, it's so incredible.
What's so you?
Yeah, I think exactly. Yeah. It's like the most like, again, Jacob coded, like super sad. We're just going to do drugs and have sex and tell each other the worst things that have happened to us in life. And like, I love it so much. But then it culminates in like him when she overdoses and him like carrying her through the streets and screaming in that wide shot in the Vista Vision of like the hospital in neon, like on that damp street. And it's so sad and it's so beautiful. And like, I think Brady Corbet, like, he, for all of his, that's funny. It's like I talked also about Nickel Boys and how, like, it's this intersection between, you know, something that you can see as, like, distinctly populist versus, like, the art house version of that same thing, is that that's what the Brutalist is to me, is that, like, he made this 4-hour epic that on, if you took it on face value, you would be like, this is impenetrable. But he does it in such a way that feels digestible and that it incorporates moments from, like, you know, the greatest American filmmakers like Francis Ford Coppola.
Yeah, it's Coppola's fuck.
To where you're connecting with it on a very, very naked, primal level. And it's really terrific stuff. Like, a lot of people say it's like PTA coded, and I can see a lot of it, especially in the Daniel Blumberg score.
Oh my God.
It sounds a lot like Johnny Greenwood at times, but like, I don't know, man, like it feels like it's really synthesizing a lot of the new Hollywood masters with, like, you know, guys like Antonioni.
Well, yeah, I mean, the La Ventura stuff, like the marble is very much like the rock formation of that, you know, the spiritual.
It's so picnic European hanging rock. Inflected too, that it's, I don't know. I think this is a really special movie that I think unfortunately has been nominated for a bunch of Academy Awards, and I wish it wasn't, because I feel like now we're debating all of its merits when, like, really we should just be soaking in the fact that, like, this guy accomplished something on a massive level with finite resources that most people wouldn't have the balls to ever attempt.
Well, and it's kind of wonderful that it connects to The Substance in that way. Two films that are really vying for number one,
yeah,
is these films by kind of outsider filmmakers who are kind of beating the odds, you know, by being these films even being released. Like all this, you know, the stories we've heard about trying to get Brutalist made for years and the lack of faith, and obviously it's kind of the point of the film. But you also have two filmmakers who are obviously film fans.
Yeah.
Like they're so inspired by, like you're saying, you have one that's New Hollywood and one that's like our love of Cronenberg and, like you said, Hennenlotter and schlock. You know?
It's like, even if you look at Corbet's acting resume, it's like, here's a guy who worked with Haneke and who worked with Lars von Trier.
Gregor Rocky.
And like, he's very much versed in the cinema of confrontation.
Yeah.
And he smuggles that into this 4-hour epic. I mean, there's specific plot points that are in there to basically shock and confuse you that wouldn't feel out of place in like a Lars von Trier movie.
Oh, no.
You know, or an Antonio Campos movie, you know, which he starred in with like Simon Killer and stuff. And like, it's just, this is who he is. It's all leading up to this one film, and I think it's really, really terrific.
Yes. Well,
here's your number one.
Number one. I saw in February and stayed number one all year, which was I saw The TV Glow, the film by Jane Sean Braun.
Bad Boys Ride or Die.
Yeah. You and I saw, We're All Going to the World's Fair when we got the Sundance Pass, 3 years ago?
Yeah.
Fuck, 3 years ago.
During COVID.
No, 4 years ago.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Yeah. So we got it, and I watched it on the screening service, and I was utterly blown away. A very tight little creepypasta movie of unreliable narrators, if we're not exactly sure what the reality is. And I was waiting anxiously for their follow-up. And I was at the Overlook Film Fest in New Orleans February. And thankfully they were showing it. I was floored by this movie. And for those of you, this is a film I feel like in a different year, released at a different time of year, would be an Oscar contender. I do believe that. I think so. I think it has the legs for it. You know, for those who haven't seen it, it is about a young boy played mostly in the film by Justice Smith, who grows up in the Midwest and is at least early on queer coded, but also is kind of an outsider who makes friends with.
I mean, the opening shot is them wandering under a giant.
The parachute
that is the colors of the trans flag.
Yeah, it's well, and Jane Sean Braun is non-binary, and this film is, from their words, very much a trans allegory. The film goes on to be about this kind of obsession with the show called The Pink Opaque, which is a mix of. Jane Sean Braun said their love of Buffy, but also it's clearly Goosebumps and. Are You Afraid of the Dark? I mean, mostly Are You Afraid of the Dark? These weird Canadian productions that when we were kids were absolutely terrifying.
Yeah.
But it has they have early on the
it's like if you remembered Snick.
Yes, it's 100% that. But mixed with the narrative mythology of Buffy and how they would have these guides.
Right.
Like X-Files had those as well, these episode guides. And I think what the filmmaker like completely nails is because it is like our age group. It's like that when they're in middle school, it's 96. And there's this, it starts out, and the first time he meets this other character is
Bridget Pundy Lane.
Who just changed their name.
Yes.
I feel bad. I don't know.
Me too.
Yeah. Amazing in this movie. And they are this fan of the show, a little bit older, like 2 years older, and is kind of. Justice Smith's kind of entry into, yes, the world of The Pink Opaque, but also into, like, the queer headspace or, like, being able to be more open. And what this film for me, not to get too detailed about it, I talked to a friend about this, our friend Daniel, after I saw it, was, you know, I had never seen a film so well as a person who's cisgender and heterosexual make me understand, like, the desire and what happens when you are not fulfilled. Being able to be trans and be out is you have this person, it has the sense of, what if Neo took the blue pill, right? What if you missed your train to being the real you? And I understand that beyond my gender, just the sense of, what if you hit 50 and you're like, fuck, this isn't how it was supposed to be.
Well, it's one of the great, if not the greatest, cinematic arguments for representation matters.
Yes.
Of like that first time that you actually see yourself on screen, or at least see something that activates that part of yourself.
Yeah.
That you think nobody else has ever kind of like seen before.
Yeah.
You know, or recognized, and also how you use that medium or a specific piece of like cult media to, frankly, like this podcast, to connect with other people.
Yeah.
And that like you use something that you experienced in your life, especially in like the genre space, to be like, hey, you like weird shit? I like weird shit too.
Yeah.
And then you discover those pieces of yourself and you're able to actually share those pieces of yourself with like that other person that you otherwise probably wouldn't have been able to, because you see that part of yourself inside of that fictionalized media.
Yeah. Well, and off of, and I love that, because also off of this too, I feel like what this film does is what Ready Player One should have done, which is the dangers of nostalgia. Like Ready Player One has an ending where it says, oh, we're going to turn it off on Tuesdays. Right. But it completely reinforces the love of all these things from the past. What I love about the way this film was shot, when this interview I watched with Jane Schoenbrunn, with their cinematographer, was everything needs to look like fucking cotton candy, like sickly cotton candy.
Yeah.
It's so sweet. And it's like, it looks appetizing, but it's going to make you sick to your stomach. Like, it's going to destroy you, because it is that nature too, of like, you have these characters who, when you do become, go down that rabbit hole, obsession with,
it's specifically the poisonous nature.
The poisonous nature of nostalgia and, like, you know, loving something from your past. And it could end up hurting you. But at the same time, the film kind of ends on a question mark, you know, of like, well, I mean, the end.
I don't know that it ends on a question mark. I think it's one of the most haunting, upsetting endings in years.
Well, I guess
it's about a guy basically denying himself his true nature.
Yeah, well, that, I guess that's very clear. But I mean, the absolute, there is a sense of whatever the reality was of the Pink Opaque, and whether they are these characters wrapped up in that, there is this moment. And the end murdered my soul. I was like, I walked out of the theater like limping. Is you have a character saying,
Connor O'Malley moment.
Oh, it's too great. But you see, like, the character is like, hey, I still have the light inside me, right? It's there. I'm going to close it back up, and I'm going to apologize to everybody, and I'm going to go back to my fucking life.
To my job.
And it's just, sorry about earlier. Sorry. Yeah. And my friend Derek had said, it's like about apologizing for the parts that you won't accept. You know, he's just going, he's like, well, I guess fuck me, you know? And it is, I walked down, I was sitting next to this guy in the theater, and he goes, scathing. I'm like, yep.
It's bad.
Yeah, but I just think it's, honestly, I love this movie. I've watched it a bunch. I think it's also entertaining. It's beautifully shot, great music, super Lynchian in its moments too, especially the scene at the roadhouse where listening to like the band play.
Yeah,
it's very like Twin Peaks The Return. But I was in love with it. I just love this movie.
Yeah, really great, upsetting, weird little movie. Totally unlike anything else that came out in 2024.
Yeah.
Only one person could have made this
too. Yes.
Like, it's the very definition of like a personal vision.
I think Scorsese called the film out for being like an exciting, so like, it's definitely a filmmaker who's like being seen by other masters and being like, this is something unique
going on. It's also one of the closest things that we've gotten in, what, now 40 years to like Repo Man or Alex Cox.
Yeah, I like that.
Like a person, like totally just
kind of punk rock,
imbuing that punk rock spirit into a piece of pop media. Yeah. Also, like if you're a collector or just a consumer of any kind of cult ephemera, like this is for you.
Yeah.
Like you, like there's a whole, you know, montage that revolves around tape trading and the idea of like, hey, I taped these next four episodes for you. Here's what they're about. Oh, watch out for episode three.
Like, this is important. This ties back to that. Yeah.
That's how you, and this is a, what do they call it? Like a legacy or a canon episode.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Versus like a monster of the week episode. Yeah. And like
it, or filler or whatever.
It taps into like what we knew network TV to be. That's now lost on, honestly, an entire generation after us, not to sound like old dudes, is that like when you watch stuff like Buffy or X-Files or Millennium or stuff like that, like there was the difference between like, oh, yeah, yeah, this week, man, like the episode was good, but it was just like the tapeworm, man. And like it was a cool monster of the week where like 2 weeks later you'd be like, dude, you got to see this because this was about the...
It's the colony, you know, two-parter.
Yeah, it was like when when Mulder's sister like totally gets like sucked up and like you have to understand it. And he gets obsessed with it again. And obviously the cigarette smoking man like comes back and like he suppresses the information and you're just sitting there like, oh shit. Like that's... There was a distinct way of consuming media that doesn't... It doesn't exist anymore.
Well, Joseph Smith literally watches the show on Netflix. Like, yeah. That's like near the end of the film. And there's a sense of like, oh, it looks like shit now. It's it's like the you know, we were talking earlier, like the idea of like, it's so accessible.
Which is also part of like, honestly, the reality of revisiting stuff like this. Because I have like X-Files on Blu-ray and I have the original Millennium like DVD set, yep, which you can't get anywhere, and like you watch some of the episodes and you go,
and you watch some, you're like, ooh,
yeah, some are awesome, but others you're like, oh yeah, this was definitely the 18th of a 22 episode, like, you know, season, and they were just filling time.
This is the maze in season one of Miami Vice. You're like, there's no script.
This is bad. They were just like, I don't know. We need an hour this week. What the fuck are we doing?
Stretch.
So, but no, I saw the TV Glow. Fucking good movie.
Hell yeah.
My number one.
Surprise, surprise
is The Shadow Strays. Timo Chiantu's epic martial arts fantasy about, that's basically like his Black Widow. Right now he is, for my money, and we've done an entire episode on this, I think he's the greatest action director in the world.
Yeah.
Nobody,
definitely for martial arts.
Yeah. Nobody's making, I think, period. Who do you think competes with Timo right now?
I mean, we talked like about
Chad Stahelski.
There's that. And I think we were talking about like, when it comes to like car stuff, like
George Miller,
someone like George Miller, but someone like, honestly, like Justin Lin at his heights of like Fast and the Furious, like Fast Five.
Yeah, no.
Yeah.
Like he's not doing Timo shit. Come on now. Don't even come at me with no bullshit with this. Dude, we're at the end of the episode.
Martin, anyway.
And you're bringing up Justin Lin. Okay.
He's pretty good.
But
just saying,
The Shadow Strays, I've watched this movie eight times, more times than I can count.
We share an account. I see it every day. I'm like, oh, he's watching it again.
He's watching it again. But it's like, for me, it's the epitome of what action movies should be right now. It's unfortunate that this movie came out on Netflix, because like it just feels like, even by those who are enthusiastic for his films, it kind of got passed over to a certain degree.
Yeah.
And like when you actually sit down and watch it, and even some of the complaints I've seen about it, like some people complain about the length and everything, and it's just like, dude, this is a barrage for 2.5 hours of the greatest martial arts set pieces you'll ever see in your life.
10 set pieces.
And it's, yeah, like the middle with the cops invading that high rise and 13, our main character, taking it all down is just, it's as good as anything you'll ever see in action cinema.
Yeah.
So like, for me, this is my number one choice. Nothing's more entertaining. Nothing's more visceral. At the end of the day, I sit down and watch movies just because I want to feel something. And like, this makes me feel a lot of pain.
Yes.
And it's just, it's action as storytelling at its pure, like kind of its purest sense. And I can't recommend it high enough.
Yeah, it's heavenly.
Yeah. Well, Martin, that's it. That's 2024.
Yeah, now we're in 2025, and it's looking to be
pretty good thus far.
Pretty good. I've been enjoying some stuff.
Yeah, so we've seen Den of Thieves 2. Yeah. We've seen The Shrouds. I've seen The Monkey. All of these movies are good. We've got a bunch of stuff coming up, you know. So, I mean, 2025, don't know if it's going to be quite the caliber as 2024, but what do we have coming up outside of that? Are we doing some Luca?
We're going deeper on Luca.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Real deep on Luca.
Yep.
And then we're also going to do some Bronson.
Australia.
Some Australian cinema, some Ozploitation, maybe some Italian trash.
Oh, yeah.
Well, you know, but you'll have to tune in next time to see what we got for you on Secret Handshake.
See you next time.
Bye.